Hello. Welcome to Audio One of Discovery Orientated Conversational Process, inspired by Janella Bird. I am Josephine Stanton. The text of this audio is on the website talkthatheals.org. The mission behind the website and these audio recordings is to make clinicians and therapists aware of the possibilities Janella's work offers. This audio includes an introduction, 5 strategies to try, and a bit of background. Tanya Windelborn and I began this project because we found that even just beginning to learn Janella's approach, we noticed an added freshness and interest to our clinical work. People seemed to find us more helpful. Sadly, Tanya passed in 2023, but the project continues to evolve. Including audios is a new development to make the idea more accessible to people who would rather listen than read. I would greatly appreciate any feedback on the website and podcasts. Please email info@talkthatheals.org. Now to Janella's work. Like the perfect golf swing or the perfect tennis shot, Janella's work looks simple and not hard to do. Her therapeutic conversations appear ordinary, but they can be transformational. The difference is felt rather than heard. Conversation focuses on the resource and agency of the people we are working with. They open space for people to feel listened to, experience, and hear themselves differently and find possibilities for movement. What is offered here, in these podcasts and on the website, is a taster, an invitation to explore. Much more can be found in Janella's books, DVDs, and website. You can access this by searching her name, Janella Bird, J-O-H-N-E-L-L-A Bird, B-I-R-D. I am beginning with 5 strategies to try. This is because the focus in this approach is on practice, the craft and what we actually do. The theory supporting it is complex, but these strategies are tools you can try to put a toe in the water, to begin to get an idea if you want to go further with this. The first strategy is consciously to remind yourself that this person negotiates a life we have little understanding of and uses skills, knowledge, and resources we want to learn about. As you ask a question, ready yourself to listen to the answer, looking for wisdom and open to hearing what you don't expect. Asking a question with the aim of bringing forward resources of the people we are working with is a different activity from asking a question to elicit information for us to process. Think of asking someone who has made an obvious blunder. What was the process you went through to come up with that solution? We are wondering how they could have gone so far off track, identifying a deficit. Compare this with asking the same question of someone who has found a creative solution to a challenging situation. What was the process you went through to come up with that solution? You are hoping to learn something which might help you. The second orientation is how we are wanting to approach the people who come to see us. I noticed an example of this contrast from my own life. When my children were little, I had a friend whose children were a bit older than mine. I really admired her parenting. I would often ask her things like, "What did you do about pocket money? How would you decide if the children could go and stay over with someone?" The purpose of these questions was to elicit wisdom, ideas which I thought might help me in my parenting decisions. The conversation was based on the respect I had for the parenting I saw my friend doing. It struck me one day at work in a clinical interview that my questions were focused totally differently. I was looking for what parents were doing wrong, gaps in their parenting capacities that I could help with. Engaging someone in a collaborative discovery conversation entails the assumption that the resources they have will be not just helpful, but essential in making the shifts they want in their lives. These resources are often not available in conscious awareness. The discovery process has the potential to bring forward the resources and make them explicit. This is in stark contrast to the deficit focus so common in ordinary thinking, particularly social and other media, and much professional thinking. The second strategy is to prioritize asking people for their thoughts and ideas over sharing ours. If we have a recommendation to give or some information we want to offer, we can try asking the person about it. For example, if we want to recommend exercise, we could say, "Lots of people find exercises helpful. Do you think it will be helpful for you?" Or in engaging people in the idea of learning emotion regulation skills, "Do you have strategies for getting through and easing strong emotions? Would you like to hear about some that other people use?" Asking rather than telling is a deceptively simple countercultural shift to practice. If we ask a question in a way which puts into practice the respect we have for people's views, they will feel that respect. In answering, they may surprise themselves as well as us. In an adaptation of the words of E.M. Forster, "How do I know what I know until I hear what I say?" Asking a question has another great advantage of being low risk if we are not getting it right. If we suggest a change in behaviour which doesn't fit with the person's capacity, ideology, or values, they often experience this as unhelpful, even though they may well not tell us. However, if we ask them what it would be like for them to do this in an attitude of exploration, we may all learn about the capacities, ideology, and values which guide their lives. More examples could be, "What sort of things have you tried or thought about trying? Are increasing social contact or looking for a job things you have considered? Is bringing these concerns up directly with your boss an option you would consider?" Similarly, for ideas we have about how to make sense of what is happening in their lives, asking about what a person thinks about an idea has the possibility of stimulating their thinking with limited risk around getting it wrong. The role of the power dynamic in a therapeutic relationship adds a lot of complexity to this, but I'll come back to that later. When we want to offer ideas or information, we can actively seek feedback. You are describing a strong emotional response in these interactions with your partner. Do you think the intensity of the response you have is partly due to old feelings left over from the abuse you experienced as a child? What comes up in your thoughts and feelings when I'm making that suggestion? My telling you about what a limited strategy telling is, I need to acknowledge, a limited strategy. But I am hoping that by experimenting with these strategies, you might notice something. I would also like to ask you two questions and ask you to notice any difference in the experiences you have as you hear them. The first question is what you are hearing in this podcast making sense? The second question is, what is coming up in your thoughts and feelings as you are hearing me talk? I have found when I am choosing to do telling that the question, what is coming up in your thoughts and feelings, has a better chance of eliciting tentative responses people have than, am I making sense? Was this true for you? The third strategy is to ask for feedback as you go along. For example, I would like to stop you for a minute and check if you're finding this conversation helpful. Can I just check, are we talking about the right stuff? You may get some surprises, I certainly have. During my training, I saw an adolescent who came to appointments, but I never felt I engaged with her effectively. About a month after I had moved to another placement, she came in specially to thank me. She asked the staff to tell me that she did not know how she would have got through that term at school without coming to see me. I was mystified. I have also had the converse experience of feeling specially pleased with the work I was doing with someone, only to find later that that was not how that had seemed to them. The earlier we can get this sort of information, the better. The process of asking for feedback demonstrates an interest in and a respect for the person. It can be surprisingly helpful and surprisingly difficult to remember to do. When I do remember to do it, I usually find it brings a pause and sometimes an unexpected and very useful answer. An example of this happened in a conversation with a young woman and her father about the low mood and lack of motivation she was struggling with. I asked if we were talking about the right stuff. They stopped, looked at each other and said no. What they both agreed we needed to be talking about was the amount of marijuana she was smoking. In this context, switching the focus to marijuana made good sense to me, but where we have a different idea, this may be an area for further discovery or negotiation. Well, that is really interesting. I didn't realise that. Thank you for telling me. Can you help me understand how you have figured that out? Or what are you hoping for in a conversation about X? Is Y something you would like to come back to later, or is it not of interest to you? When we feel a conversation is not going well, eliciting feedback can give a welcome opportunity for reflection and possible refocusing. When we have a high level of certainty that we are on the button and doing something useful, eliciting feedback about how the other person is experiencing the conversation can be even more important. Our certainty could reduce the sensitivity we have to picking up on tentative doubts in the other person. There is a risk of sweeping them along with our enthusiasm in a direction which may not be so helpful. When someone is venting, it can be particularly helpful to ask them if they are finding the conversation useful. Some people report venting being particularly useful at times, although it can use a lot of time going over the same ground. Enabling someone to pause and reflect can require significant assertiveness in this context. Sitting forward and a hand gesture can help. Can we stop for a moment? I just want to check in. Are you finding this conversation helpful? If you are, that is great. I am more than happy to be here and be part of it. Let me know if you notice it not being useful anymore. I would also like to check in with you again. Would that be okay? We may need to provide support to enable people to give feedback. In the socio-cultural environment we operate in, there is an underlying expectation that we are the experts, there to draw on the knowledge and skills we hold. This frame does not support people to bring their thoughts and responses forward. Particularly if they only have a tentative or half-formed idea, they may well not let us know, even if we ask, full stop. Making explicit anything we notice in the room can help. For example, I noticed a very quick yes without much time to consider. If you did have a sense that we need to shift the focus of the conversation, how easy would it be to let me know? Would there be some worry about the need to be polite or worry about hurting my feelings? I noticed some change of expressions on your face and some looking around. What did you notice in your thoughts and feelings when I asked you that? I noticed in the beginning of the conversation you seemed to be talking more freely than you are now. Has something I've said made it less easy to talk? Are you noticing some judgment or criticism? In a family context, another family member can be helpful. For example, do you think that Marianne would tell me if she wasn't finding this helpful? How likely would she be to feel able to say that, or would she be likely to just go along? Would you be able to tell by her expression or body language? These conversations are potentially risk with discovery opportunity around issues which are not only important for the therapeutic process, but also for negotiating any relationship. The fourth strategy is to focus on agency. When hearing about traumatic events or overwhelming hardship, it is natural to offer empathy, to acknowledge and validate how hard it must have been. But we can also explore the agency and resources the person drew on to survive. We can ask about what the person did or is doing, how they approached the situation. That certainly sounds tough. How did you get through? What kept you going in the face of all that? Early in my career, the recommendation was made that people be described as survivors rather than victims of trauma, a simple linguistic maneuver to support agency. This is a start. We can do a lot more by engaging people in a collaborative discovery process, exploring the detail of how they got through, what support was available, and how they were able to make use of that support. This can be personally affirming and bring into conscious awareness resources which could be useful in their current lives. People use a vast range of strategies. Dissociation or cutting off part of their awareness is common. Many people maintain ongoing vigilance, actively looking out for a hint of a slight or untrustworthiness in others. Some limit the interpersonal contacts they have in their lives. Some people focus on protecting younger siblings, taking up adult roles in their families, or avoiding vulnerability and dependence on others. It is easy to pathologize these strategies, but we can also explore them as choices which they have made and used agency to engage in. This is an example I have made up, drawing on my experience of many real conversations with mothers struggling to parent against the odds. Therapist, they sound like grueling times. What kept you going? Mum, the kids. I would not abandon my kids. I get stoned every night when they are in bed, but I am always there for them during the day. Therapist, the determination you describe to be there for your kids, where in your life did you learn that determination? Mum, no one was ever there for me. I hated that and I did not want that for my kids. Therapist, I'm really interested in that. You can imagine someone saying, no one was there for me, how could I be there for my kids? But you are not saying that. You are saying that what you have taken from that experience of not having people there for you is a determination to be there for your kids, to make it different for them. There are many possibilities for exploration. Some possible next directions could be, how does this determination to be there for your kids show itself in everyday life? How do you manage to get through the days without using marijuana? What or who supports you with that? Asking for feedback is important. Specifically, we need to check explicitly for any judgment she is experiencing in the conversation. The fifth strategy relates to when we notice judgment coming up in ourselves. Before I met Janella, my response to myself experiencing judgment was to shut down that response and note a problem which might be returned to. Shutting down the response is obviously preferable to expressing judgment, but it can also mean a missed opportunity. When judgment comes up for me, I'm noticing something. This something, which I cannot name in the moment, may be an opportunity for exploration. It is possible that in experiencing the judgment, something of significance in my life is being triggered. I may need to address that in another context. But an inquiry made from a position of profound respectfulness carries low risk of harm to the conversation, and I might be surprised. When I had not long been working on learning Janella's approach, I met a woman seeking help for her son, who was about 11. He did not want to be in the room, and she suggested he go to the shop and buy a drink. She gave him some money, and what followed was a complex conversation about what he was to do with the change. He appeared a little agitated at times. I noticed judgment coming up in myself, something like, this woman cannot set a limit. Ideas of how to upskill her in limit setting started to form in my mind. However, thinking of Janella's instruction to hold the judgment and make an inquiry, I asked her about how she managed money issues like this. I was surprised. The complexity and sensitivity of her thinking about it filled me with admiration. I had nothing to teach her about managing limits with her son. I find it useful to have doc questions which come easily to mind, such as, is that the approach you usually take? How well did that work for you? How did you make that decision? What did you think about? What were the hopes and values that supported the decision you made? In response to a parent lecturing, haranguing, or criticizing a child, how well do you find this works at home? Can be a useful question. I find the parent will often laugh and say, not at all. In response to a negative comment to someone else in the room, what are you hoping Marianne will take from this? Can help a person reflect and bring forward resource. Where someone is describing being in an abusive relationship, it might be helpful to ask, you are describing a lot of hurt and pain from what happens in this relationship. What keeps you there? That is the end of the five strategies to try. I hope they provide, at least, food for thought. The last few minutes of this audio describe some of the context Tanya and I brought to this work. At the time we developed the first version of the website, Tanya and I were working in a fledgling child and adolescent community mental health service in northern New Zealand. There was a lot of poverty and disadvantage, but also a richness of community spirit, cultural heritage, and a commitment to supporting children. 50% of the population were Māori, the indigenous people of New Zealand. Tanya was Māori. Reflecting on it now, I realise that though Tanya and I both grew up in New Zealand, She had grown up in a non-Western Maori world. Conceptualising the world in a more collective relational way came naturally to her. Her professional training was a degree in nursing she had started after having her children. She took to Janella's work like a duck to water, using it creatively in all sorts of contexts. In contrast, I had grown up in a Western individual-focused culture. I trained as a doctor, specialised in psychiatry, and engaged in a range of therapy training. My own family background was somewhat unconventional, but I had a whole lot of indoctrination into cultures and mini-cultures I had to fight my way free of. Tanya was immensely helpful to me in that process. This is one of the many things I miss about her. I am hoping that in my struggles, I have developed some conscious awareness of the challenges I faced, which can be helpful to others. While learning from Janella, I have been working as a psychiatrist. This is a very different context from that as a therapist. Psychiatrists in New Zealand were, and still are, a scarce, expensive resource. My time has always been spread thinly over the people I met. A strong value for me, which comes down the generations, is to be as useful as possible. Core tasks I have had to achieve in my work include diagnostic assessment, managing risk, medication prescribing, and use of the Mental Health Act to support compulsory care. Despite this, I have long held an ideal for every interaction to be a therapeutic interaction. The attention Janella pays to the therapeutic relationship in every conversation and the structure of every sentence was just what I needed. I can bring the awareness of the stance she uses to every conversation. This is the end of Audio 1. Thank you for listening. Welcome to Audio 2 of Discovery-Oriented Conversational Process inspired by Janella Bird. I am Josephine Stanton. The text of this audio is on the website talkthatheals.org. That's talkthatheals.org. The second audio introduces the section on six key points of difference and describes the first one. Six key points of difference in Janella's approach. Janella's approach is profoundly countercultural. This is what makes it so intriguing and liberating. However, it can also be profoundly disturbing. It challenges much that we hold dear. I am bringing some points of difference forward to invite you to make a positive choice to engage with them with curiosity. When faced with something which is disturbing, it is a common response to dismiss, ignore, or focus on ways in which it is wrong. I find conversations about these responses to Janella's work intriguing. They help me learn. I am interested in hearing about the points of tension and what people find disturbing. Please let me know, along with any other feedback, on info@talkthatheals.org. info@talkthatheals.org. The first point of difference I'm going to talk about is profound respectfulness. The resources people have, but may not be consciously aware of, are key to making the changes they want. Profound respectfulness is at the heart of Janella's work. It is not the intention that is a point of difference, but the practical skills and strategies which enable us to engage people in a collaborative discovery process, crafting conversations which put this intention into practice. Moving into this frame has transformed my work. Almost as soon as I began trying to use Janella's approach, I found I enjoyed my work more and people seemed to find me more helpful. My development of new skills was negligible. In fact, I may have lost skill as I would have lost spontaneity with my old strategies in the process of trying something different and new. I wonder now if people found me more useful because they could experience my shift in attitude. Meeting a new person started to feel like an opportunity to learn something new, something only they could teach me, rather than as a challenge to make sense of or fix. As professionals, we are not coming as naive inquirers. Engaging people in a collaborative discovery process is a skilled craft. It requires 100% focus, emotional and cognitive presence, flexibility and openness of thinking, attuned observation, and all the professional and personal knowledge, skills, and experience we have. It can be useful to share some of this knowledge with people who consult us, but crucial to enabling change are the skills and strategies we have in bringing forward the knowledge, resources, and sense-making processes the other person brings to the conversation. Each of us has our own experiences, skills, and knowledge of living with ourselves, the relationships we participate in, and the socio-cultural context we inhabit. We all have values, desires, hopes, intentions, and dreams, which are crucial to our sense of ourselves as worthwhile people and to building lives worth living. Any of us would struggle to negotiate anyone else's life if just transplanted into it. I know I would. Most of this is not held in conscious awareness. We negotiate our everyday interactions and decisions on an intuitive level, but they rest on a lifetime of learning and experience. They reflect our values, attachments, and so much more. For people who read Malcolm Gladwell, this is what his book Blink is about. An art expert may be able to identify a fake at first glance, but behind this fast recognition is decades of finely honed expertise and experience. The tone and specific language a mother uses to encourage a teenager to get out of bed and go to school is similarly supported by so much. The love she feels, the desire for the teenager to engage in education, the understanding of how it is for them to go to school, and so much more in a lifetime of relationship. Some of this may be helpful and some less so. Usually none of it is in conscious awareness. She just does it. But it is possible, if it is of interest to her, to engage in a collaborative discovery process to bring all this into her conscious awareness. This can contribute to active reflection and enable all sorts of possibilities for change. This collaborative discovery process stands in stark contrast to the approach of identifying deficits we can help with. The traditional process of assessment, formulation, and engagement, creating a platform for intervention, is turned on its head. Each part of each conversation has therapeutic potential. There is growing interest in identifying people's strengths. Janella's approach goes beyond the identifying of resources. It uses them as a beginning point for exploration, not as an answer or end in themselves. Much of what is identified in this focused exploration would not have been named in an open or differently focused conversation. Identifying agency and resource was one of the first practical applications of Janella's work I was able to grasp and put into practice. For example, some young people acknowledge being reluctant to let their families know the extent of their distress because they do not want to hurt them. I would be quick to identify caring and showing consideration for others as something they engaged in and give myself a tick. I had identified a resource. It has taken longer for me to learn to use the identifying of this description of taking care as a starting point for exploration. For example, you are identifying a worry about causing your mum distress. I was wondering, this care you take around your mum, is this something you do with other people as well or just your mum? There are many possible directions to go with this. Do you think she notices that you do this? Where did you learn about taking care not to cause others distress? Is this something which happens a lot in your family? Key in all this is the focus on each person as an active agent, making choices, even if they are not noticing that they are making choices. This is the fourth strategy described in Audio 1. Slowing down the conversation and supporting the person to move between being immersed in their experience and reflecting on it enables the person to notice choices so they can explore what is supporting the choice. This is described more in discussion of the third point of difference in Audio 4, taking up the power we hold for the benefit of the conversation. Welcome to Audio 3 of Discovery-Oriented Conversational Process, inspired by Janella Bird. I am Josephine Stanton. The text of this audio is on the website https://talkthatheals.org/. This second audio describes the point of difference number 2. This focuses on addressing the power relation in the therapeutic relationship. The risks of this power dynamic are widely acknowledged in the prohibitions on engaging in sexual contact with a client or patient. but much less attention is paid to the more common and subtle risks of the person in the client or patient role feeling misunderstood, missed, or discounted. These experiences can and do happen in any interaction, but there can be an added potency if they happen in what we are hoping will be a therapeutic relationship. The therapeutic relationship is set up with the expectation that a therapist will have particular expertise in understanding and making sense of our experience. These expectations enable the person seeking help to relate in a more open and less guarded manner. However, they also open the risk that where there is an experience of feeling misunderstood, missed, or discounted, the person might feel that this indicates there is something the matter with them. They are more likely to resort to silence or just not come back than let the expert know they have got it wrong. Being misunderstood in a friendship without this power dynamic and these expectations of a special expertise can be very different. I had an experience of this in the period some months after a bereavement. I was on a bike ride with friends. I had difficulty negotiating a small obstacle and became quite upset, almost tearful. I described the intensity of my feelings to my friend and asked, Is this the sort of thing everybody experiences? My friend replied, I don't think so. That's anxiety. This did not ring true for me, and I pondered on it. As I became increasingly clear that this didn't fit for me, I was able to find a description for it that sat more comfortably. I decided it was not anxiety, it was grief. I felt relief. In being able to name the tumult of emotions I was experiencing, it was easier to accept them. The conversation with my friend had felt very helpful. The clarity of my internal response of, no, it's not that, helped me make sense of it in a way that worked for me. It might have been very different had we been in a power dynamic where I was expecting her to have more understanding of my internal experience than I did. I might have been troubled by my failure to identify this anxiety and wonder what the matter with me was that I experienced so much anxiety. We may not seek or value the power people experience us holding in the therapeutic relationship. We may not even notice it. This does not mean it is not there. We tend not to notice the power we hold in any relationship. The power we experience others holding in relation to us feels much more apparent. I had a lesson in this from a man in a forensic hospital. I was asking him about his life, and he seemed quite guarded. He asked me how I could expect him to talk openly in the context of the power I held over him. The power dynamic he was naming was obvious. He was subject to controls under both the criminal justice and mental health legislation. He was likely to be locked up for years and would be dependent on reports from professionals for regaining freedom. However, I had not noticed this power differential. I was a junior registrar and felt no one would take any notice of my ideas in making significant decisions about his life. In fact, they might have read observations I put in his notes. But I felt like a small fish in a big pond, conscious only of a desire to find a way to be helpful. I felt, and was, very naive. As a clinician, I have often felt stuck and powerless, particularly when I don't seem able to be helpful. I have experienced powerlessness in the context of holding responsibility for detaining a person in hospital and treating them against their will. I expect this does not approach the level of powerlessness experienced by the patient. But when we experience powerlessness ourselves, we are at even more risk of losing sight of the powerlessness the other person is experiencing in relation to us. We cannot disappear the power relation by being open, warm, unassuming, and accepting. In fact, this could even make the power dynamic more insidious and difficult to address. Someone feeling disempowered, disrespected, or not heard by us may be even more vulnerable to concluding that there must be something wrong with them if we are so nice and supportive and they're not able to feel comfortable with us. We need to be active in engaging the person's participation in a collaborative process. We can begin by exploring the hopes they have for the conversation. A starting point might be, if this conversation was useful to you, what do you hope would change? Ongoing negotiation of the agenda can be supported by checking in, as in strategy 3 described in audio 1, or in the context of drawing threads together in point of difference 3 described in audio 4, we might ask something like, Are we talking about what is of most interest to you? Or, if we are giving a summary, of these themes we have been talking about, what are you most drawn to? Positive action to engage participation in building trust and safety together is also needed for a collaborative discovery process. This will be described in Point of Difference 3 in Audio 4. As you can see by my referring all over the place, this division into strategies and points is somewhat artificial. They are overlapping and interdependent. The power of the conversation comes from the interweaving of the strands. Unless we engage in active prioritising of a person's own knowledge and resources, they are at risk of experiencing their knowledge as of less value than the knowledge we hold. If we make sense of the person's experience in a way which does not sit well with them, they are at risk of taking up our ideas and dismissing their own. The setup we work in prioritises the knowledge we hold so that our knowledge will trump theirs and send their knowledge underground. It takes positive action on our part to prevent this imposition of knowledge. Colonisation provides a stark example of imposition of knowledge. The colonised people suffer losses in many ways. One of them is devaluing and even loss of the knowledge, custom, language and mores of the colonised group, who risk coming to experience themselves as of less value. A practical example of this is the knowledge held by generations of the Indigenous people of Australia in using controlled burning to manage the risk of forest fire. The navigation skills used by the Pacific peoples to find relatively tiny Pacific islands in the vast Pacific Ocean have come dangerously close to being lost forever. Power dynamics and prioritisation of knowledge are two sides of the same coin. Making sense of this requires a postmodern epistemology. On the website, I have included some context and exploration around this. Imposition of knowledge is a subtle process and will happen without being apparent in the natural flow of conversation. We need 100% focus on identifying opportunities to interrupt this flow and bring forward thoughts and feelings coming up for the other person. What is happening in the room is alive with possibility. Describing the responses we notice in the room can enable the person to bring forward something they may only be barely aware of themselves. We may hear all sorts of things we don't expect. For example, can you put words to those tears? What was I saying when you started to notice that sadness? I noticed as I asked that question there seemed to be a lot of thought. What was the effect of the question? That laugh, is it an amused laugh, an embarrassed laugh, or something else? I noticed you smiling as your mum talked about the behaviour problems. Was there a fun aspect? We also need to be attending to the responses we are having. As discussed with respect to noticing judgment in Audio 1, we may not want to describe the responses we are noticing in ourselves. They may be telling us more about our own lives than those of other people. But we are noticing something. And an inquiry in the spirit of profound respectfulness is low risk. It may open up something which surprises us. As in Strategy 2, described in Audio 1, when we do tell people about our ideas, we can take care to minimise the risk that we trump their knowledge. We can ask them for permission to offer our knowledge and actively seek the responses they are having, for example. Would you like me to tell you about some of the things I've learned about and seen in my practice that relate to this situation? What are you noticing in your thoughts and feelings as I am talking? I notice you shifting around in your seat and looking away when I mentioned X. Did you experience some discomfort around that? If you did have some worries about what I am saying, would you be able to let me know? This is the end of Audio 3 on how Janella's approach addresses the power relation in the therapeutic relationship and the associated risk of doing harm, particularly by imposition of knowledge. Thank you for listening. Feedback or ideas are welcome on info@talkthatheals.org. Trial of Janella's work on the website. Welcome to Audio 4 of Discovery-Oriented Conversational Process inspired by Janella Bird. I am Josephine Stanton. The text of this audio is on the website https://talkthatheals.org/. The focus of this fourth audio is the third point of difference, taking up the power we hold for the benefit of the therapeutic process. A collaborative discovery process will not happen if we go with the flow and follow the lead of the personal people who consult us. We need to take up the power we hold and actively craft conversations which invite reflection so that people find a way of speaking about what they might not have noticed. Casual, friendly conversation can increase people's sense of connection, which is essential. We can't be of use to people without connection. Some sort of being with as two human beings is needed for that. But connection and being with do not address the risks entailed in the power relation. The power dynamic may augment the benefit people experience from our paying attention and demonstrating interest. Hearing their words and ideas spoken in the room as we do a reflection or summary can be particularly validating. But we can do much more than this. Using the power we hold to slow the conversation down can open space for people to have a different experience, to hear and feel themselves and each other in a family context speak. For example, I want to stop you and slow down the conversation. What you are saying is important, and I want to be sure I am getting it. This not only allows us to hear the other person, but it enables them to hear themselves, and it enables us to attend to the responses we are having, what we are noticing in the room, how we can support them to reflect, and identify what has possibilities for exploring further. Sometimes people speak as fast as they can to pass on as much information as possible about their or their child's predicament. They do this in the hope that the more information we have, the better, wiser response we will have to offer them. However, nothing new happens in a conversation like this. These conversations can lead to the frustration people describe in telling the same thing to professionals over and over. In a family conversation, so much happens in a short time in the room, often repeating familiar patterns. If we are to discover anything new, there needs to be a change to these patterns. Slowing the conversation down gives us a better chance of identifying and focusing on possibilities to explore. Using the power we hold to interrupt the flow supports the person to move between being immersed in their experience and reflecting. We can open space for discovery by using the power we hold to interrupt the flow and support the person to move between being immersed in their experience and reflecting on it. For example, can I just check, is this the usual way you do things? This sounds important. Is this a familiar experience? In the context of family members interacting, I want to stop you and just ask, does this sort of talk happen a lot at home? Does the intensity of the anger you are describing relate to the strength of the love you feel for Johnny? This invites the person to shift from being immersed in their experience to look in on what they're experiencing from a wide-angle view, placing the experience in a wider landscape. Focusing on the detail of a single event rather than general statements about what happens can help us find opportunities for exploration. For example, this sounds so tough, what's been going on. I would like you to focus on one event so that we can get some detail. Can you choose one example, any example, on one day you remember clearly, and we can talk about that from the beginning? What happened next? What would I have seen if I had been looking through the window? When people move back into general statements, we can prompt them. Is this what happened last Wednesday? Summarising themes and drawing threads together with careful use of language is another way of slowing the conversation and providing opportunity for reflection. Summarising enables everyone, including us, to reflect and process. In listening to the summary, the person can experience the validation inherent in the attending we've been doing, and they can hear us speak their views aloud in the room. Using their words and the kind of language described in audio 4 also helps. A summary also provides a platform for negotiating the focus of the conversation. Does that cover the main themes which have come up? As you are hearing me describe them, what are you drawn to? What seems most interesting to you to follow up with? Gathering in threads from an earlier part of the conversation and making movement explicit has potential for exploration. I noticed that we started talking about X, then moved to Y. Is there a connection between them? If we don't gather the threads, then we risk losing all but the last few minutes of a conversation. Another important use of the power we hold is to engage people's participation in a process of building trust and safety. In the traditional, widely held idea of a good therapist or clinician, we are required to be attuned, nurturing, empathic, validating, and trustworthy. In this view, we hold the responsibility to create safety and trust in a therapeutic relationship. In Janella's approach, building trust and safety is seen as a process we engage in together. The therapist has responsibility for taking care of the therapeutic relationship. Part of this responsibility involves taking active steps to engage the other person's participation in building trust and safety. If this conversation was becoming uncomfortable or unhelpful, what would you notice? Would you be able to let me know, give me a sign? I'm wondering what would make it easier for you to let me know. If I asked you directly about how comfortable you were feeling in the conversation, would you be able to answer honestly, or would you find yourself pretending things were okay? Is there anything I might notice that could cue me in so that I could check? Engaging a person as an active partner in a discovery process around managing safety and building trust can be therapeutic in itself. Identifying and communicating concerns or discomfort in any interpersonal interaction has challenges for most of us. Making this process explicit in the therapeutic relationship has opportunities for important learning and trying out shifting habitual behaviour. Sometimes with young people I take a light-hearted approach to this, similar to what Marsha Linehan will call irreverence, and ask them if they would clean my bicycle if I asked them to. Would they pretend they were enjoying it? This is the end of audio 4, focusing on taking up the power we hold for the benefit of the therapeutic process. Thank you for listening. I would love to hear any feedback or ideas you have on info@talkthatheals.org. Welcome to audio 5 of Discovery-Oriented Conversational Process, inspired by Janella Bird. I am Josephine Stanton. The text of this audio is on the website https://talkthatheals.org/. This fifth audio describes the point of difference number 4, which focuses on exploration of each person's unique experience within a social and cultural environment. We hear what we listen for. A collaborative discovery conversation requires us to listen for opportunities for discovery. Our natural way of listening is to categorize, to fit what we hear into something we understand and have knowledge of. To keep listening for unique aspects of a person's experience with a focus on opening inquiry takes a lot more cognitive effort. We can listen in many different ways. In a social conversation, we might be listening for a description of an experience we resonate with, an opportunity to tell one of our favorite anecdotes, or a description of an enjoyable travel experience which gives us an idea of where we might spend our next holiday. We listen differently with different amounts of focus depending on our relationship with the person who is talking. The therapeutic approach we're using and ideas we have also orient the listening and observing we are doing differently. In any approach, we might be listening for universal human experiences such as loss, grief, or loneliness. Listening for indications of specifically defined diagnoses is a particularly tightly prescribed process. In motivational interviewing, we will be listening for opportunities to elicit change talk. In CBT, we might be listening for core beliefs or unhelpful thoughts or cognitive distortions we have strategies to address. In an assessment process with the goal of a psychological formulation, the therapist may be listening for traumatic events, experiences indicating attachment problems, or indicators of use of psychological defences. Any of these could help build the therapist's understanding of what the person is experiencing. All these processes involve involve focusing listening on identifying themes and threads which fit categories in our thinking. These approaches of listening and observing are core to evidence-based psychological interventions. Most of us have put a lot of time and effort into developing competence in using them. They yield information, which guides us as to strategies which are shown to be helpful and information we can give people. Offering people an explanation informed by psychological theories, diagnostic systems, and information about other people's experience is often helpful. It can be a relief for people to find they're not the only one. Having a therapist make sense of experiences they are having can be validating and reassuring. Clinicians can offer interventions which make a difference. We use this sort of listening in a collaborative discovery process to bring knowledge and experience we have to the process of guiding inquiry. Crucial to Janella's work is holding this sort of listening in the background while orienting to listening for this person's experience and responses in their unique context. We are looking to go beyond what we know and understand, beyond categorization, and beyond what the person holds in their conscious awareness. We know we are on the right track when the person says something like, "I didn't know I knew that." This focus on listening for the detail of what the person is experiencing and doing in their individual context makes our work much more challenging. We need to hold lightly, and maybe even let go of, the experience of competence in identifying, "I know what this is." We don't know what anything is for this person unless we can support them to put their experience into words and tell us. It also makes our work so much more interesting. I am often surprised what I learn about how people are negotiating their lives and relationships and how they are experiencing this conversation with me. I have an example from my personal life I have permission to use in this context. Becoming a grandparent was an exciting prospect for me. Many of my friends had spoken about how they loved being a grandparent. While it has been a great source of joy and discovery to me, I have also found challenges I didn't expect. I felt unsure how to conduct myself in a new context with my daughters and their partners. I experienced the doubt about my parenting skills with this new infant for whom I felt such strong feelings, but who was unfamiliar and wasn't my child. I had little in the way of parameters to guide me as to what was required of a grandparent. I noticed myself comparing myself with the child's other grandparents, resulting in feelings that I didn't match up. When I have talked about these challenges with my friends who have been extremely positive about their experiences as grandparents, they have described sharing many of the challenges. They seem to appreciate their being named and open for discussion. When a friend of mine talked about becoming a grandparent as being an emotional roller coaster, I responded by validating how challenging I and others have found this new role. Then I stopped, thought again, and asked her about what the roller coaster was for her. This opened a conversation about her anticipation of becoming a single grandparent rather than becoming a grandparent with her children's father, from whom she had long been separated. Reflecting on her individual circumstances had the potential to open up a conversation about issues quite different from what other people had described. An important one was the feeling she had about his new partner being part of the family. In writing this, I asked for her feedback. She reported finding it validating to hear that other people also have struggles in becoming a grandparent, but felt that being invited to tell me about the specific experiences she was having was validating on a deeper, more connecting level. She was endorsing a both-and approach, appreciating validation of both generalizable and specific aspects of the experience. In my initial response to my friend's description of becoming a grandparent as challenging, I put it together with other similar descriptions I had heard. She experienced this as helpful, but in doing this I lost detail. Going beyond the categorization to ask about her specific experience and her context opened the possibility of a richer conversation. Focusing on unique aspects of a person's experience is one of the ways we interrupt the flow. It is part of what is so countercultural, exciting, and challenging in using Janella's approach. Putting things in categories and connecting them with other experiences we have had are strategies we all use and couldn't live without. They help us make sense of the world and access relevant knowledge and experience. The depth of knowledge and experience we have augment what we offer people in a collaborative discovery process. We do not serve people best in the role of naive inquirer from a not-knowing position. Our knowledge and experience can inform our inquiry and help us identify opportunities for exploration so that we can go beyond them. Hence the importance of keeping our listening open to what surprises us. This contrasts with the ideal of a therapist as someone who has such a high level of attunement and ability to read people that they can know another person more completely than the person can verbalize or communicate explicitly. In any human interaction, it is a special experience to feel understood without having to use words. However, the collaborative discovery process requires supporting the person to put their thinking into words. Making the implicit explicit increases what we have available in conscious awareness with the possibility of identifying agency and resource. Responding with warmth and accurate empathy offers the person something important, but they don't learn anything new. The accuracy of this empathy is likely to be partial at best and risks shutting down rather than opening up exploration, even if we have got it mostly right. Simply asking, "What do you mean by X?" or "Tell me more about X," can be helpful, but asking about an experience in context can help focus the person's experience on the detail of their experience. For example, the desperation you felt when you heard David had lost his job, can you put words to this desperation? How did this desperation affect you? There can be an experience of validation, an immediate expression of understanding. As with my friend, when I initially identified other people's experiences of finding grandparent challenging. But there is a risk of loss of detail and the richness in the detail. In order to bring out detailed understanding, we need to use the power we hold to engage people in carefully negotiating meaning, using the person's own words where possible. Using the person's own words in the process of negotiating meaning supports the meaning they are holding, even though we may have only a beginning of understanding. When we change the words they use or make assumptions about their meaning, the person may experience this change as implying that we understand what they are describing better than they do. They may shift from attending to their own experience and try to make sense of what we are meaning. This results in imposition of meaning. Their meaning, which might have been only partially moving into conscious awareness, goes underground. We lose detail in the understanding of their experience. The understanding they could access from their internal processing will always be richer than any understanding we can develop. This is the end of Audio 5, focusing on exploration of each person's unique experience within their social and environmental context. Thank you for listening. I would love to hear any feedback or ideas you have on info@talkthatheals.org. Welcome to Audio 6 of Discovery-Oriented Conversational Process, inspired by Janella Bird. I am Josephine Stanton. The text of this audio is on the website https://talkthatheals.org/. This sixth audio describes the point of difference number 5, which focuses on relational externalizing, that is, conceptualizing and describing everyone and everything in relation to everything and everyone else, including moments in time. It involves quite a shift, especially for people who've grown up in westernized, individually focused cultures, people like me. For example, the sense of desolation you felt as you saw your daughter walk away. This description centralizes the experience, desolation, is separate from and connected to the person. It places it in the context of the relationship with her daughter and a moment in time. The detail in the description supports the person to connect with being in the experience. The separation supports reflection, moving out of the experience and looking in on it. I'll say it again. The sense of desolation you felt as you saw your daughter walk away. Another example might be the furious rage you experienced as you heard your partner accept an invitation to watch the game. In contrast, ordinary language tends to identify the person with the problem, often using binaries and absolutes. Some examples might be, I am depressed, he is violent, she is dependent. Traditional externalizing was an important innovation by early narrative therapists like Michael White and David Epstein. It separates the problem from the person as if the problem has a separate agency, a life of its own. For example, what sort of effect does depression have on your life? How did hitting get into this family? When did the stealing start? How has that sneaky poo got into your pants? It is pretty crafty. Using traditional externalizing, the therapist and family members can engage with the person to address the problem. It is especially helpful with young children. With issues open to judgment, it can reduce experiences of blame and shame. It has been moved into institutionalized mental health care in evidence-based treatments as evidence-based treatment of obsessive-compulsive disorder in children. It's also widely used by people working with anorexia nervosa. For example, is that you or the anorexia talking? Did that mean OCD make you use up all the hot water again, even though you didn't want the family to run out of hot water? Me, your mum, your dad and your sister, we are all on the team to help you get that OCD out of your life so that you can choose when to turn off the shower and get into doing all the things you want to do. Relational externalizing is an innovation developed by Janella. It places the issue in relation to the person in context. Here are some more examples. The suicidal feelings you experienced as you walked away from your friends. The guilt and self-hate you experienced after you told your grandmother you did not care about her. The desperation and confusion you felt when you learned your son had taken an overdose after you had had such a good day together. The shift to using language in this way can look a bit clunky when written, but it doesn't seem to feel like that to the person. Like traditional externalizing, it creates space between the person and the problem, but it puts the feeling or idea in relation to the person. The person has an opportunity to experience themselves as an active I, having the experience that is of me, but not the whole of me. Relational language has the potential to free us from black and white or all or nothing thinking, enables us to shift from a deficit-focused view to engage in possibility and to use imagination as a therapeutic resource. In contrast to the black and white thinking or all or nothing binary thinking of ordinary language, relational externalizing helps us find language for the in-between. Binaries or absolute descriptions are common in ordinary language, but they don't do justice to the complexity and richness of our experiences. Consider these examples. I am a good mother versus I am a bad mother. I am a confident person versus I lack confidence. I have good self-esteem versus I have poor self-esteem. I am a good clinician versus I am a bad clinician. A binary allows only two positions, the valued and the not valued. It is rare for anyone fully to belong at either extreme, and neither is a great place to be. No one wants to be on the negative end of a binary, but being on the positive end is precarious. If you fail, even once, to keep up the high standard required by the valued place in the binary, what is left? If I am seen as a good rather than a bad clinician, does that mean that with one error of judgment, I stop being a good clinician and become a bad clinician? How can someone offer me formative feedback if identifying something I might do better could imply I am not a good clinician? Once I move out of binary thinking, I can hold my sense of value as a clinician, even if I become aware of a situation where I was not able to contribute. I can reflect, consult, and explore how I can develop and enrich the skills and knowledge I bring to the role. In comparison to absolute binary descriptions, relational language allows a richer, more detailed level of description. For example, the confidence you showed in leading the team through the new exercise, the valuing of yourself as a likable person you continued to hold when going to the new school, even when the other kids did not initially invite you into their friendship groups, the good mothering you showed when you managed the intense feelings you experienced and stayed calm, supporting your daughter through the painful procedure. Whatever lapses in confidence, loss of self-esteem, or not good enough mothering that may happen at another time, these events have happened and cannot be cancelled out. Consider the contrast with black and white descriptors such as a good mother, a confident person, or being someone with high self-esteem. We can explore the context and use relational language to shift a totalizing black and white response. For example, I am hopeless might shift into the pattern of setting high goals for yourself and pushing your limits has worked well for you in many situations. It matters a lot to you to do the best you possibly can. However, you sometimes find yourself taking on more than you can manage. In trying to achieve the impossible, you have found yourself falling short. In the process of becoming aware of falling short, you are finding it impossible to hold any sense of your abilities and become overwhelmed by a sense of hopelessness. Relational language can help us move away from a deficit-focused approach. Take the attribute of confidence as an example. Everyone displays some confidence in some context, even if only in everyday tasks, such as brushing teeth or buttering toast. Conversely, it would be unusual to find someone who displayed confidence in every situation. Consider a conversation about the confidence you showed when, in comparison to a conversation about being a confident person or not. Here's some examples. Is there anything good enough about the parenting that you do that the Child Protection Agency hasn't noticed? The anxiety that you were describing when you are under pressure at work and when you meet new people, are there times when it doesn't affect you? Relational language also allows us to recruit imagination as a therapeutic resource. What the person can imagine is likely to be more connected to their life than something we suggest. For example, what would this family be like if the children did what parents asked some of the time? If this fear your baby will die, which keeps coming into your mind, started to change, what would be the first sign? This judgment you are making of the parenting that you do, if you were to put it aside, what would be different? If you thought it was possible to develop some trust in this relationship, what would it be like? What would you hope for? What would be different? If you were to be the nurse, OT, social worker you really wanted to be, what would you be doing? If your koro, grandfather, were here, sitting over there, what would he be thinking? What might he say? Relational language is important in summarizing themes in conversations. The detail in the description supports the person to connect to the experience. The space created around the experience and describing the context support the person to log in on the experience. This not only protects against losing what has gone before in the conversation, but holds it with richness. It provides a multifaceted platform to negotiate the ongoing focus of the conversation. Summarizing in this way requires a therapist to write careful notes as the person is speaking. A fictional example. I want to stop and collect up some of the threads of the conversation. We have covered a lot of ground. We have talked about the longing you have to be connected with your daughter and the desire you hold to be present as a mum for her. We have also talked about the sacrifices you have decided to make to support this. You have described the desperate emptiness you experienced when you lost touch with her and the hurt you experience now when she pulls away from you. We have also talked about the experience you have of being alone, just me and all this. Does that cover the central issues? In my own life, personal and professional, I find relational externalizing a helpful strategy for processing the blame and shame I feel when I have not met the standards I hold for myself. This is an example where I have not attended as well as I might to someone at work. I am noticing feeling burdened with unhelpful self-recrimination about not having listened particularly attentively to X. Nothing terrible happened, but I might have been more helpful if I'd taken more time and trouble. They have not had the best I could do. In the context of being tired at the end of a long day, wanting to get home to my family, I made a choice to do only what was necessary. The values I hold which supported this choice include taking care of myself and being psychologically available to my family. This choice is of me, but not all of me. As I describe this experience in a relational way, I notice a change from aversive self-recrimination to sadness that was all I felt I could manage. This is the end of Audio 6 describing relational externalizing. Thank you for listening. Feedback and ideas are welcome on info@talkthatheals.org. Welcome to Audio 7 of Discovery-Oriented Conversational Process inspired by Janella Bird. I am Josephine Stanton. The text of this audio is on the website https://talkthatheals.org. This audio describes the point of difference number 6, which describes the process of building a sense-making description or narrative to transform suffering into manageable pain. Pain is an inevitable and important part of life. The stories we build around painful events can intensify the distress we experience by generating feelings such as guilt, fear, shame and blame, abandonment, worthlessness and rage. It is common in any disaster associated with someone we love to add considerable suffering to the unavoidable grief and loss by making up stories about our having failed the person, not done enough. A collaborative discovery process engages the person in building a narrative or sense-making description in which they experience as intellectually and experientially coherent. Woven within this narrative is evidence confirming and producing a sense of personal agency. Incorporating the values and intentions they hold is personally affirming. Developing a narrative or a description like this can have the power to move the suffering generated by the stories our minds build into manageable pain. This can shift the experience of being disempowered and immobilized to provide a platform for movement. For this narrative to have the power to make this shift, it needs to be built out of the knowledge, values, experiences, and intentions the person holds. All our professional knowledge and experience cannot build such a narrative for someone else. The knowledge, experience, and skills we hold are important in helping us identify areas for exploration, but we cannot know what the person will bring forward. What they bring forward will often surprise them. A traditional psychological or biopsychosocial formulation developed collaboratively, that is, collaboratively in the sense of asking for ideas and checking with the person as to whether it is making sense to them, can also help with shifting suffering, but it is unlikely to have the same sort of power. If in any collaborative discovery process we find ourselves saying, "Does this make sense?" this is a red flag, and we need to consider whether we are developing the narrative and checking that we are taking the person with us, rather than using skills and engaging them in exploration to build the narrative out of what we find together. I have illustrated this with examples from my own life. This is not because my life is so fascinating everyone wants to read about it, but that I have permission to use my own information and the detail needed. The first example from my own life is around processing the loss of my younger sister. She died after a completely unexpected heart attack. Losing her was painful. There is no quick and easy way through a loss like this, but my mind made up a story of how I had let her down. If I had tried harder, I could have prevented her death. This was not completely outside the range of possibility. She had had an unusual illness in the week before the heart attack, which her doctors realized after her heart attack might have been unstable angina. If this was the case, and she had had an EEG during that illness, she could have had a stent and heart surgery before the heart attack happened. She would have had a good chance of survival, possibly for many years. She had had no specific pain, even when the heart attack happened. She had consulted her GP, I made several offers to go and see her, offer her help, but she turned these down. On the other hand, she did seem significantly unwell with no sign of improvement for a week. I still wonder whether I could have, somehow, ascertained that this was a very odd illness and persuaded her to go to a comprehensive face-to-face assessment by clinicians in gowns, masks, and gloves to protect them from the possible infection. An ECG might have identified unstable angina, if indeed it was there. In the intensity of the story that I had let her down, I was suffering. I found myself unable to engage in life, work, and relationships. Neither could I accept or begin to process her loss. My focus was on fault in myself, on guilt, shame, and harsh self-judgment. I discussed possibilities with my GP, thought of how, post-COVID, we were much more circumspect about having contact with people who were ill and could be infectious. I talked with other people and reflected on the values which had supported the decision I had made not to go against her wishes, see her in person, and interfere with her healthcare choices, even if I could have accessed the assessment. In retrospect, I regret that decision, but I have made sense of how I made it and the context around it. I am left with sadness, but have been able to let go of the suffering. I moved into feeling the loss, a loss I could share with my family and friends. The suffering I had been so alone with was transformed into manageable pain. A more multi-layered example occurred in the context of my having a five-minute slot to speak to the review committee overseeing the rewriting of the New Zealand Mental Health Act. This opportunity came up when I was away on a sailing holiday with my husband. On one level, it seemed pointless to interrupt this precious time for a five-minute slot, but the Mental Health Act has such power over so many people's lives, I wanted to take up the opportunity of any influence I might have, however small. Making a Zoom appointment on a sailing holiday is challenging. Internet access is variable. Choices we make about where we sail, when, and where we anchor are dictated by the direction and strength of the wind. This is hard to predict. I booked a slot at midday, hoping it would work out. The day of the appointment, we had internet access, but we also had the wind we needed to move to the next harbour, about 20 miles away. The wind tended to drop away later in the day, so it was frustrating to have to delay our departure to the afternoon. I zoomed in and waited my turn. I was a little flustered, but spoke clearly and felt I had made reasonable use of the limited time available. Despite this, after it was over, I was overwhelmed with distressing feelings I struggled to name. They were something like shame and incompetence. A family member whose judgment I respect had happened to watch and rang me, indicating support for how I had spoken. I appreciated the call, but there was only a brief attenuation of the distress I was feeling. I rang a friend and vented briefly, but she had limited time available and we were keen to set off. As we all know, wind and tide wait for no one. The sails were ready, we started the engine and pulled up the anchor. I struggled that afternoon. I was aware that I was being irritable, picky, and fault-finding, but I didn't seem able to stop it. This added to my distress. I knew it was to do with the hearing, but I couldn't make sense of it. Of course it felt belittling to be given 5 minutes to speak to such an important issue when I had nearly 20 years' experience in thoughtful, careful use of the existing Mental Health Act. Our unit had led the way in stopping use of seclusion. I knew my friend would understand those things immediately. She had, but as with the phone call from my family member, it had made only a momentary dent in the distress I was feeling. My mind was building a story around, what's the matter with me? Through the afternoon and evening, I festered over it and struggled to manage my behaviour. I was able to enjoy the remote, unspoiled beauty of the sail and our next anchorage, but it was tempered. I apologised to my husband for the way I was behaving, but the well-oiled cooperation and shared joy, which were usually part of these holiday activities, were somewhat dampened. After considerable self-reflection and some collaborative discovery conversations with my friend, I was able to make sense of the experience I was having. This was a process rather than an aha moment, and I have done my best to describe it succinctly. I figured out that speaking to the review committee for the Mental Health Act was a triggering an experience I had had in an inquiry over a decade earlier. This inquiry was an important piece in the puzzle, But just making that connection wasn't enough to take the heat out of the effects of the "what's the matter with me" narrative. The patient involved in the earlier inquiry had not died, but there was concern about the approach to care we had taken. This involved responsible risk-taking, minimising coercion, and optimising the patient's autonomy. It was supported in the recovery movement and DBT approaches, but was well ahead of standard practice. We did not use seclusion and avoided use of restraint, even in contexts such as her head banging or informing us of sharp objects inserted in body orifices. We had a locked area in the unit, but minimised time young people spent there and supported escorted and unescorted leave, even when there was risk of absconding. The choices we made for someone with intense, unstable emotions and ongoing risk to self would not have been seen as so remarkable now. What is likely to make a difference to their risk in this context is a shift in their ability to manage emotions and distress, combined with hope of a life worth living. Physical containment and restraint can give an illusion of containing risk, but also have the potential to undermine recovery. The lead member of the inquiry team did not support the approach we took. The flavour of the inquiry reminded me of cross-examination of witnesses with the aim of discrediting them that I have seen in televised courtroom dramas. There were two specific points where I remained silent when I could have spoken in my own defence. In one, a specific choice I made was misrepresented in a misleading and negative way by one of the other witnesses. I could easily have given more context to explain the choice, but I didn't. There was another point where I had completed a legal form inadequately. I had explained my thinking in my clinical notes, which the inquiry team had access to, but the brief statement I had made on the legal form was inadequate. This was brought forward in a way which made me look incompetent. Again, I could have spoken to the context, but didn't. The advice we had been given by the legal team was to say as little as possible in case we made things more difficult for ourselves. I am also aware that in clinical work, engaging in an argument is seldom constructive. But neither of these things accounted for my failure to speak up where I was being misrepresented to my detriment. I had taken up a victim role of powerless passivity. This was fertile ground for my mind's narrative around "what's the matter with me," which flooded me with feelings of shame and incompetence. I had thought I had shifted this experience in a recent inquest. In preparing for the inquest, I was determined I would not repeat the failure I remembered from the inquiry. I would speak what I knew. This was also fueled by the experience of sitting at my sister's bedside in ICU, knowing that she might die as she did. It was a great comfort to me that she was getting good quality care. I found it unbearable that the parents of the young person who had died should suffer not only the loss of their child, but also not be able to make sense of the care that she had been offered. I had prepared carefully for the inquest and felt satisfaction in the way I had been able to answer the family's concerns about their child's care. I could not make sense of why this had not superseded the previous experience of my taking up a victim role. It took some collaborative discovery conversations with my friend to make sense of my taking up the passive role in the earlier inquiry. Key to this was an episode of sexual abuse by a stranger I had experienced as a child. Though I did run away, initially I went along without challenging the abuser, despite uncomfortable feelings I could not name and process. I had lived most of my life feeling it was not particularly significant. In the process of writing the book, Finding Hope in the Lived Experience of Psychosis, I described this episode and found it was more significant than I had realized. Doing some structured exposure with self-soothing and distraction took some of the heat out of the effects of the experience. But in a conversation with Janella about this exposure as an example of a therapeutic process, she named the abuse of power I had experienced. This shook me. It was an aha moment. I had long been puzzled about a pattern I had noticed in myself of becoming disempowered and unable to respond effectively to some situations which could be described as an abuse of power by a man in the room. Once I had the conscious awareness of the connection with the childhood episode of abuse, I have never felt immobilized in this way again. However, the inquiry had happened before I had developed the conscious awareness of the abuse of power in that childhood experience. In the conversations with my friend, I made sense of the inability I experienced to speak in my defence in the inquiry as connected to the childhood sexual abuse. I made sense of the distress I experienced after my 5-minute Zoom with the Mental Health Act Review Panel as triggering a re-experiencing of the immobility I experienced at the inquiry. I did not become similarly immobilised in speaking to the Mental Health Act Review Panel or at the inquest, but speaking before the panel reactivated the older experience of being immobilised at the inquiry. I could not explain exactly why, but it didn't matter. I now had my cognitively and experientially congruent narrative based in my unique circumstances. I had made a sense of the tumult of feelings I was caught in after the Zoom. The power completely went out of the "what's the matter with me" story. My state of mind changed drastically. I was no longer irritable, picky and unpleasant, hating myself and feeling flawed. I felt pain and sadness. I felt pain about the experience of the abuse, about the experience of the inquiry, about the loss of opportunities in the intervening decades and situations with controlling men. Most of these have been in clinical contexts, where there has been a man in a family taking up a power position. I have not been as helpful to the family as I could now that I have made sense of the connection to my own abuse experience. I felt pain on behalf of all the people involved in abuse of power in our world, all the people who have been through sexual abuse and so much more. The experience which had affected me in these significant ways was minimal in comparison with what so many other people have been through. I also learned and reflected. I reflected on how I had dismissed the episode of sexual abuse from my childhood and what a difference some small interventions had made. I was able to talk with my husband about the pain and sadness I was feeling, which brought us back into connection with each other. I realised that this episode was an example of what Janella described as the power of a narrative, which is experientially and cognitively coherent, created in a collaborative discovery conversation with my friend. In my experience of sadness and loss, I was no longer alone. I was looking and moving forward. Though my friend is a skilled therapist, this was not a therapy conversation. It was a conversation between friends. We have a long history, finely honed in the process of writing our book together, of working through issues, valuing the connections and differences in our thinking processes and worldviews. The role she took up was of helping me to figure it out. She listened attentively, was present and responsive. Her responses were affirming and validating. She also brought forward ideas and asked challenging questions. In this context of our friendship, we did not have the risks associated with the power dynamic in a therapeutic conversation where I would be experiencing her as an expert on my life. Where she raised an issue or asked a question which I did not experience as congruent, I found it helpful in clarifying my thinking. Rather than prioritizing what she was saying and trying to fit my thinking to hers, the response which came to mind was, "No, it wasn't like that, it was like this." Intimately as she knows and understands me, skilled and knowledgeable as she is in making sense of human beings, I doubt she could have formulated it on my behalf. As I reflect on the narrative she helped me develop, I can see how someone else may not find it congruent. There are other narratives which would also fit the details of my life and experience. But I had an experience of agency, of sorting out my thoughts, emotions, and experiences. I knew she had helped me a lot, but on an experiential level, I felt I had done it myself. This is the end of Audio 7 on the sixth point of difference, the power of a cognitively and experientially coherent narrative to transform suffering into manageable pain. Feedback and ideas are welcome on info@talkthatheals.org.